You are listening to Tell Somebody on KKFI 90.1 FM. I'm Margo Patterson, your host for today's show. Flack Miller is a professor of religious studies at the University of California at Davis and the author of the new book, The Audacious Ascetic, What the Bin Laden Tapes Reveal About Al-Qaeda. Trained as a linguistic anthropologist, in 2003, Professor Miller began translating 1,500 audio tapes U.S. forces found in Osama bin Laden's house in Kandahar, Afghanistan, in 2001. He is the only person who has listened to the entire audio library, which spans the years from the 1960s through 2001, and feature more than 200 speakers, including bin Laden himself. Professor Miller joins us today to talk about his book. Professor Miller, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
Well, let's start by talking about how you got access to the tapes and became the person who translated them. How did it happen?
Yeah, it's an unusual story. I don't have intelligence clearance. I haven't spent my history with intelligence or security. I'm a professor, and these books, these audio tapes were acquired initially by cable news networks. So that was the first kind of moment. It wasn't the FBI or CIA. They offered them to the FBI and CIA to kind of listen to right after 9/11. These tapes were acquired again in Kandahar, Afghanistan, from bin Laden's house. The FBI and CIA listened to them and, I guess, declined stewardship, from what I hear. And so the tapes were passed on to academics at Williams College. There was a Williams Afghan Media Project that was well-known in Afghanistan and in the States. Those folks didn't know Arabic. I'd spent years in Yemen, bin Laden's ancestral homeland, studying Islam, political reformation, especially poetry and political poetry, and the ways tribal poets were using audio tapes, which is the technology we're talking about here. So I just was the right person at the right time, and they got me involved at that point in 2003.
One of the central points in your book is that Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda were not at all synonymous, that Western policymakers exaggerated the degree to which the two were identified and the degree to which al-Qaeda was focused on the West. How did Osama bin Laden get to claim the mantleship of al-Qaeda?
Yes. Well, this seems like such an obvious point to us now in light of 9/11 and everything that happened. After 9/11, of course, the public was looking for immediate answers. Those answers were provided in ways that the public could understand, and they were kind of expedient, but they were obviously much messier. As we know, in retrospect, none of the 9/11 hijackers, most of whom were Saudi, had anything to do with Saddam Hussein or Iraq, and that was where our executives and other kind of public will went after 9/11 with the Iraq War, and where al-Qaeda wasn't there before, it certainly was after. So there were messy stories about like what al-Qaeda was and why Americans needed to be worried. Those stories preceded 9/11 as well. I could talk about more of that, but, you know, when I listen to these audio tapes, there's actually a lot of debate on these tapes among top al-Qaeda operatives about who's in charge. And others have spoken about infighting. What is not often spoken about is the ways in which the story of al-Qaeda is coherent and its unity to drive, you know, the fight toward the United States and ultimately lead to 9/11, that story was produced more over here than it was, that is, in the United States and in Western among Western security experts, than it was produced over there. That is to say, I don't hear anywhere on any of these tapes, except in one case, which is early 2001, I don't hear that al-Qaeda spoken about as a worldwide militant organization or united under bin Laden with its goals to target the West. I hear it much more as an organization that's dedicated to overthrow corrupt Muslim authoritarian leaders within the Islamic world.
Well, the book makes clear that for both Osama bin Laden and for al-Qaeda, there are initial targets were other Muslims, Shiites, Baathists in Iraq and Syria, communists, Nasserites in Europe. I want to ask you to explain their hostility to some of those groups, and particularly their animus against the Shias, because I myself don't really understand what fuels the Sunni-Shia discord. You know, I understand that it goes back hundreds of years to within the first couple of generations after Muhammad's death, when his followers were divided over who should lead the community, that the Shias wanted the leadership to pass to Muhammad's descendants, and the Sunnis thought it should go to whoever was most capable. But, you know, right. That was an argument 1,000 years ago. For today's Sunni radicals, what makes the Shias so objectionable?
Right. So Bin Laden, first of all, was a Saudi citizen. And Saudi Arabia, through the 20th century especially, developed a very strong kind of sense of its Sunni identity as separate from Shia. There are Shia Saudis. But with the growing centralization of power under the king, and that has the whole oil history behind the rise of modern Saudi state, some dissidents and some opposition movement to the House of Saud, you know, took on a religious element, as they do in that part of the world, and some of those groups were Shia. Now, it was easy for the king to begin identifying the Shia as, in sectarian terms, as the ones who were primarily to blame, Shia minority. So, too, Iran, its rise to power, certainly the 1979 revolution that brought Ayatollah Khomeini to power, a major moment, and sent shockwaves across the world, but especially in the Sunni, among Sunni neighbors. So those are some of the reasons that the Shia-Sunni tensions, as regional state tensions, really began breaking out. You know, we see today Al-Qaeda's vibrancy in the Middle East like never before, and much of that Al-Qaeda's message remains anti-Shia, as it does for ISIS and other radical groups in Syria and Yemen. And that all of those, the seeds to that kind of hatred and radicalism are very much part of Bin Laden's own past, and something we're not really told about fully when stories were told of Bin Laden's ability to actually be a bridge builder between radicals.
The Sunni radicals who populate Al-Qaeda are against the ruling government in Saudi Arabia. You would think that the Shia might be their allies, but that obviously is untrue. How are the Shias kind of depicted or in these tapes?
The Shia are often depicted in as innovators, and theological innovators, as people who, have kind of fallen the wrong religious paths or too ritualist, too involved with saint worship and so forth, which are kind of, crazy charges, but that's nevertheless kind of the Sunni extremist rhetoric. The state itself, like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, other major states in the region, they would let preachers like that kind of speak against Shia, but they were very wary about having preachers speak about the United States in those ways, because the U.S. and the West are their prime allies. And many folks like Bin Laden, they felt like the West was leading the Muslim world in the wrong direction. They may have had some grievances against the West for that reason, but more often than not, folks like Saudi Arabia found common cause with the West, as did the Saudi state, in fighting communists, foremost, of course, in Afghanistan. So, many decades of collaboration between the United States and the Mujahideen during the Soviet, the Cold War, to drive the Soviets out of Afghanistan. So that was a common fight, of course, the Arab-Afghan fighters, but also South Yemen, where there were many communists, and the U.S. Worked with Saudi Arabia to destabilize South Yemen, and other revolutionaries who were of that stripe in Libya, Egypt, Nasser, so forth. So Bin Laden found it easier to, and Al-Qaeda found it easier to kind of play by the state's terms in taking on those communists and taking on the Shia than it did fomenting revolution back at home.
And the hostility to communism, was that, for members of Al-Qaeda, was that politically based or was it religiously based? Why were they so fiercely anti-communist?
It was because of the many years in which the Arab world had built solidarity around powerful states that were, you know, that especially in the oil areas, the petro states, the message of communism was one of, you know, mobilizing kind of large mass political movements toward electoral reform, toward kind of more multi kind of representative pluralism. Certainly there were communists, but a lot of the communists, they were very keen on literacy campaigns, for example, education, massive state support for education, and a lot of it was kind of quite westernized. It was kind of Soviet, you know, education, but it was not Islamic doctrine by any means. And so states, obviously authoritarian leaders saw that as a threat. So they would use, you know, the arguments about, well, these guys are anti-Islam or anti-state in order to persecute them and to build their authority under kind of authoritarian Islamic states.
In the West, I think many people have the impression that Osama bin Laden founded al-Qaeda. But al-Qaeda began in 1988, and it's my impression that initially he had nothing to do with its founding. Is that correct?
That's right. So the first historical evidence we have of anything called al-Qaeda, that people among the Arab Afghans or Arabic speakers recognized as an al-Qaeda, was a base in Afghanistan called Al-Farouk Base Camp. And it was set up in the late 1980s in eastern Afghanistan to support training for Muslims who had come to Afghanistan but knew the Soviets were on their way out and were looking to kind of return back home to their home countries to support Muslim insurgencies as they fought corrupt dictatorial state. So, you know, those included like the House of Saud, and those included Egyptians under Hosni Mubarak, or Libyans under Muammar Gaddafi, or Saddam Hussein in Iraq. So a lot of the militants at Al-Farouk, this base camp, supported bringing the revolution back home. Bin Laden, of course, was seen as an asset at that camp. He had a lot of money. He was from a wealthy Saudi family, and his money was welcome. But the problem with his money is that it always came with strings attached. Saudis and Gulfies, generally Arab Gulfies, were seen as people who had money, but the strings that came with the money were, don't bring your revolution back home. And that was, you know, what the Saudi donors in the state made clear when they gave their money. And that's not what those militants at that base camp wanted. They did want to bring your revolution back home. So bin Laden was attractive as a financier, but he, again, in the charter document for this base camp, there's an explicit clause that says, you know, none of the emir of the camp's guards can be from Yemen or Saudi Arabia. And it's kind of an explicit, bin Laden's not named, but it's an explicit attempt to marginalize the Saudis, like bin Laden, their influence on this camp, because they were not seen as someone who could be trusted to bring that revolution back home. So the question then is, well, how did bin Laden manage to portray himself as a base commander, as someone who could ultimately take the headlines and for al-Qaeda? I mean, he didn't have the training as a base militant guy. He didn't have religious training. So I ultimately show in my book the ways in which he had to struggle. And after losing all his wealth in the Sudan by 1996, he was exiled to the Sudan for 6 years after he was kicked out of Saudi Arabia for fomenting revolution against communists in South Yemen. And he was also stripped of his assets. His money had disappeared through poor investments in Sudan. At that point, when he was exiled from Sudan, left stateless, no money, what did he do to represent himself as a base commander? Well, he went to the West. He went to CNN, ABC Network News. He began making outlandish statements to them about his power as a base commander. It's at that point that the bin Laden story really began taking off in ways that, you know, not even that bin Laden himself was not even fully a master of.
Well, could you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, those stories made a lot of sense to the West, that idea of him as this threat, because of the ways in which Americans were being asked to ramp up military engagements in Iraq to unseat Saddam Hussein. And the ways in which many Americans were like, why should we get involved? Saddam Hussein's not, you know, going to attack the United States. And so both the executive power and intelligence communities, they began kind of looking for ways to kind of market this idea of a pan-Islamic global jihadi network that was out to get the U.S., that it was well-financed. Bin Laden was the guy who, you know, the CIA felt could best represent that. And so they first began floating reports about him publicly as the Ford Foundation of Islamic Terrorism, and they did that in late 1996. But that by that point, he had lost all his money. He was no longer a Ford Foundation. He was no longer, didn't have anywhere with all to pull off the strike. But at that point, the Bin Laden story got going. It began scaring people, news networks would come to Bin Laden and say, hey, are you responsible for the 1993 World Trade Center bombing? As, you know, some, including National Security Advisor Anthony Lake, you know, was probing in that direction in the early, in 93 after the bombing. But of course, Bin Laden was not involved with the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. Al-Qaeda was not involved. Those were Egyptian militants. So, but Bin Laden would be asked this question by news networks, and he would say, yeah, I commend those attacks, and our brothers have worked hard for that. And then they would ask him, well, were you responsible for the 1995 National Guards bombings in Saudi Arabia, the 1996 Khobar Tower bombings, which 19 Americans were injured in 1996. He said, you know, he began taking credit for those kinds of things, even though he was not involved. You know, history is not shown any involvement of his in any of those attacks. So there were there was a story, in other words, being drummed up, and kind of created in order to galvanize public support for the war in Iraq, for the increasing air raids. And then, of course, after 9/11, the public was ready to have that be the story.
So he aggrandized his role, and that was very convenient to Western policymakers. But why were they so focused on Iraq? Why did they need to, what were they trying to achieve in Iraq after the first Gulf War?
The Cold War had ended. This was a new era in which the United States was looking globally to kind of, well, what can our role be, both, you know, as, you know, a force for the good, and what should our role be in helping various nations seek security in this time of great change. And, you know, the Middle East was seen as a place that had been an ongoing place of a lot of kind of destabilization and stability, but also primarily a place of resources. America's, you know, access to oil was very much crucial, and kind of how to secure that, and as well how to continue policing the, you know, and deploying bases and building bases in the Middle East that could, you know, our military bases, such as Qatar, we have in Qatar, you know, and other and many other places. How could we, you know, prepare and justify building these bases in that part of the world for the post-Cold War era? And this idea of an Al-Qaeda network that was unified globally in the way a state might be, but also decentralized and could erupt, you know, in all of these different locations through these kind of networked capacities, that addressed that kind of image, addressed the Navy's concerns for it addressed the Marines, the military, the Army's concerns for deployment in different areas. It addressed the concerns the Navy had for continuing funding for nuclear subs with, you know, that they needed a kind of a single state-like threat to justify the sub expenses. So, anyway, you know, remaking Iraq became the kind of vision that had been set out in the 80s, and after the Cold War, it was very much primer. And of course, our involvement in 1990 in Iraq with the first Gulf War, that really set the stage for saying, okay, President Bush had made this effort. He had not unseated Saddam, and it needed to be resolved.
This is Margo Patterson with Tell Somebody on KKFI 90.1 FM radio. If you're just tuning in, I'm talking to Flag Miller, a professor of religious studies at the University of California at Davis and the author of the new book, The Audacious Ascetic, What the Bin Laden Tapes Reveal About Al-Qaeda. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm thinking the earliest tape of Osama bin Laden in the collection you translated is from 1988. What do we learn from that tape?
Yeah, that's a tape. There's a two-way receiver radio being heard on this audio tape. There's static, and then every now and then a transmission from another, like CV, like walkie-talkies, we call them.
Mm-hmm.
And what we hear is an actual military operation in the process of unfolding. And we hear Bin Laden's voice coming on and people going back and forth. Bin Laden is making kind of directives and comments to someone else. And they call Bin Laden Abu Qatada, which was his nickname. And Abu Qatada is kind of speaking to another militant as he's going to bomb something, to blow something up. And I was listening to this tape. I was like, interesting. You know, what is this? The more I listened, I realized this was in the late 80s when Bin Laden and his associates were in Afghanistan. They were just about 10 miles across the border. They'd set up a little training camp, and they were testing out their munition skills against Soviet troops in coordination with Afghan Mujahideen leaders. And so Bin Laden, he didn't have a major role in that conflict, but he nevertheless, in order to kind of burnish his credentials back home among his supporters, he ventured across the border and gave his hand at blowing up a little munitions dump. So that's the first tape we hear him working on.
Well, let's talk about a second tape. In September 1993 is the first time Osama bin Laden publicly speaks of the danger of the United States. In the tape, he talks about how Mahatma Gandhi could serve as an inspiration for Arabs and how the boycott Gandhi directed against the British could be a model for Arabs to launch their own boycott of U.S. goods. He also calls on his supporters to write U.S. embassies to complain about U.S. foreign policy. So there you see him or hear him espousing peaceful ways to act against the United States. And he seems to have only arrived at violence as a tactic later. What do you think led him to move from nonviolence to violence?
Yeah, this is a very interesting moment. It's, again, this is in 1993, 3 years after U.S.-led military forces have been in Saudi Arabia and in the Gulf, having driven Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. So troops are there, but Bin Laden doesn't speak about that. He rails consistently against infidels occupying the Arabian Peninsula. But through 1993, those infidels are always Muslims themselves. They're corrupt Shia, as I said, they're communists and so forth. So by 93, though, he's beginning to want to try to raise... He's increasingly marginalized. He's been kicked out of Saudi Arabia. But he's welcomed back for this one speech in which he talks about the recent Oslo peace accord announcement that was to bring peace between Palestinians and Israelis. And he criticizes the United States in light of that peace treaty. We hear him appealing to Gandhi as someone that might, you know, suggest the ways in which America might be confronted, and that is not by force, but by nonviolent protests and boycotting of American goods. For Bin Laden to raise any other more militant possibilities for confronting the U.S. would have gotten him thrown in jail in Saudi Arabia at the time because, you know, the U.S. and Saudis were chief allies. So the moment in which we see Bin Laden negotiating inside Saudi Arabia to kind of raise the pressure against the United States, but turning to Gandhi in order to kind of maintain connections with state leaders, even as he tried to get, you know, to ramp up the political stake. And this is something that al-Qaeda has done well and consistently does well. It is even as it targets various enemies, you know, whether in militant terms or just demonizes them, al-Qaeda also works carefully to maintain its relations with state powers. We see Bin Laden doing that in this case with Saudi Arabia.
Well, now, you say there's a significant difference between the way that speech was intended and how it was presented by Western media and policymakers. Can you talk about what you mean by that?
Yeah, that's in reference to his 1996 declaration of war, as it came to be known in the West. It was a speech made in Afghanistan in 1996. Again, Bin Laden's at the kind of the depths of his career. He's lost all his money, his sway. He's been made stateless, citizenship in Sudan. So he's in Afghanistan. He goes to Western, you know, news and comes up with this outlandish speech. And it's a speech in which much of the speech he decries the Saudis for human rights abuses, for corruption, for using oil, you know, for their own benefit. and for doing so under the Western protection. But he also takes on the United States, you know, more explicitly and says, we're going to become fighting you and your interests. But in this speech, the last quarter of this speech are 15 poems that Bin Laden begins reciting. And most of the time when translations are done in this speech, all that poetry is dropped out. But, you know, for any Arabic speaker, when we just hear this speech, that is the section that is the most riveting. A lot of Arabic speakers, you know, when they heard Bin Laden, they said whenever he turned to theology or to religious doctrine, like, they started to yawn. Because there were so much more interesting people and persuasive people talking about Islam in the Middle East. He was not an expert in that. You know, he couldn't hold forth. He didn't have the training. But when he moved into poetry, that's when he really galvanized listeners. And the whole way in which the speech was couched was to galvanize them around the idea of a noble Arab past that had been betrayed by their own Muslim leaders. And Bin Laden can appeal to that noble tribal Arab history through poetry. He goes back to the 6th, 7th, and 8th centuries to these early poets and says it's their values of chivalry, of dignity, of courage that will guide our Muslim youth. And in fact, it's not, you know, Islam has come along and perfected those values, but really what he's calling for is he's calling out for Arabs to kind of take arms against corrupt Muslim authorities themselves and to do so much more ethnic and nationalist terms than I think many Western listeners have been able to hear, largely because all that poetry is dropped out. It's often just dropped out from translations in English.
Many Western commentators have said Osama bin Laden came late to the Palestinian cause, that it was only after 9/11 that he started speaking about it in an effort to widen his appeal to Muslims. Your research indicates otherwise. In fact, you say that though Americans believe that bin Laden's initial hostility to them stemmed from the U.S. stationing of troops in the Saudi kingdom during the First World War, what really anchored his hostility to the United States early in the 1990s was U.S. support for Israel and the Oslo Peace Accords. Why do you think Western policymakers and commentators have gotten that wrong or have glossed over the role of Palestine in fomenting Osama bin Laden's hostility to the United States?
When folks are asked kind of why does Al-Qaeda hate us, you know, one of the responses is, well, it's because of American foreign policy. You know, in the region especially, and it's one of the foremost reasons that many in the Arab world cite as a problem with U.S. foreign policy is its ongoing inability to help resolve the Israeli and Palestinian conflict. In fact, the U.S. has continued unabated billions of dollars support for Israel, even as it has continued to expand and settle these, you know, the contested occupied territories and Palestinian regions. So, but that explanation often is a controversial one in the U.S. And so one of the responses among folks is to say, well, that stuff never mattered to bin Laden. Come on, let's be real. He just hated the West and he hated everything, you know, we stood for and we stand for. I say, actually, there were many kind of shared enemies that bin Laden had with the U.S. through 1993. So he continued to identify, you know, Shiite Iran as his prime enemy. He continued to identify communist holdouts as his prime enemy. Libyan revolutionaries fighting Muammar Gaddafi. Like, those were all common fronts that the West also was battling. So there's a reason in which bin Laden's particular positions, like support of the Palestinians and so forth, has been overlooked is because that gets into the nuances of the deep-seated problematic nature of the U.S. involvement in the region that are often just dropped out when, you know, bin Laden and Al-Qaeda come to the talking point.
You write by late 1998, an estimated 80% of the Taliban leadership in Afghanistan opposed Osama bin Laden's presence in their country. Why did they oppose him being there? How was it that he continued to stay in Afghanistan?
Yeah, the Taliban had a number of different movements, different leaders in different parts of the country. There was a Kabul leadership in the east. There was Kandahar leadership in the southeast and different ethnic groups. So by no means were the Taliban united. Many of the Taliban leaders favored ongoing diplomacy and rapprochement with international powers, including the United States and the West. We had delegations from the Taliban leadership, right, in the United States in the late 90s. and they were seeking diplomacy. So Bin Laden, among those groups, and those were the majority, was seen as a huge liability. Now, one of the leaders who felt like he could support Bin Laden was actually was Mullah Omar in Kandahar, Afghanistan. And Mullah Omar had, in the early 90s, been seen by Afghanis generally as a possibly pro-U.S. voice because he was trying to broker an oil arrangement with UNOCAL to bring a pipeline across Afghanistan to bring Central Asian oil through Afghanistan into Pakistan to a port. And Mullah Omar thought, well, I could be a facilitator for bringing, you know, this oil pipeline across Afghanistan. Well, that was tremendously controversial. And as Mullah Omar sought to build power, he saw Bin Laden as someone who could maybe convince Afghans that, in fact, he wasn't just a U.S. puppet, that he did have kind of an anti-U.S. bent. And right at the time that Bin Laden kind of began ramping up his anti-U.S. message in 96 and afterwards, that was exactly when Mullah Omar said, okay, well, I can find a home for you here in Kandahar.
In 2000, Osama bin Laden survived 6 assassination attempts, at least 3 of them launched by the Saudis, who had a few years earlier stripped him of his citizenship. Why did the Saudis want to kill him in 2000?
So bin Laden had early on, right after Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait in 1990, bin Laden had returned from Afghanistan and said, King Abdullah, I can lend you my men to drive Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. And Hakim Abdul said, no, there's no need, we've got the West. And bin Laden then said, well, what's my next role? And the Saudis just said, well, we don't know. Bin Laden took the opportunity to begin fighting more communists, and those communists were in Yemen, in South Yemen, which had unified, North and South Yemen had unified in 1990, formerly South Communist Yemen unified with North Yemen, which had been pro-Saudi and pro-U.S. So bin Laden began fighting South Yemen, but the Saudis did not support that kind of stuff. So they, at that time, so they told bin Laden not to get involved. And he did. He kept getting involved. He also began mixing with other Egyptian Islamic Jihad folks and other militants in the Sudan who had a more explicit anti-Saudi line. And the Saudis began to feel like he could potentially be a threat, and that it would be easier to take him out. As the records suggest, that there well certainly were assassination attempts starting in the early 90s against bin Laden. Most reports suggest that nobody knows exactly who was involved. Everybody denies it, but the most likely people who in the Muslim world who would have pulled off assassination attempts were Saudis, as well as Libya, Muammar Gaddafi, and as well as Yemen. In fact, the first arrest warrant for bin Laden was issued by Muammar Gaddafi. The first one was arrested by Yemen in 1994, quashed. A larger one was sent to Interpol in 1997 to arrest bin Laden. But the British MI6 quashed that arrest warrant at Interpol with the U.S. support. And the reason was because bin Laden was seen as an asset to support Libyan revolutionaries trying to unseat Muammar Gaddafi, and Britain was very much in that game. So they saw bin Laden as a valuable man. So there were these assassination attempts. There were attempts to arrest him from Arab rulers through the 90s. The West actually, you know, put in abeyance. And this is certainly, you know, a kind of a very hard and difficult thing to kind of think about and acknowledge as we think about kind of what happened in those late 90s years leading to 9/11. But it's part of the messy and true history of al-Qaeda that my book conveys.
This is Marco Patterson with Tell Somebody on KKFI 90.1 FM. I'm talking to Flag Miller, author of the new book, The Audacious Ascetic, What the Bin Laden Tapes Reveal About Al-Qaeda. Professor Miller, today there seems so much more focus on the Islamic State than on Al-Qaeda. Do you see the Islamic State as a natural sort of offshoot or heir to Al-Qaeda? Could you talk a little bit about the differences between the two? Has Al-Qaeda become almost irrelevant given the prominence of the Islamic State?
Look, Al-Qaeda is certainly, you know, kicking. It's alive and well as a organization or as an idea that it, you know, it's a brand that people continue to mobilize in Syria, in Yemen, often against Shia, but in some respects against ISIS. So the differences between ISIS and Al-Qaeda seem to be ones that are quite large. That's the story we often get. Ideologically, they're very similar. Both of them are very much Sunni militant movement. Saudi and Gulf Cooperation Council bankrolled in many respects, and you know that their prime intellectual armature is coming from the Arabian Peninsula, as well as indigenous movements in Syria and Yemen. So ISIS has arisen in the wake of the turmoil in Iraq. ISIS is now a state, quite heavy centralization, and is doing and resources. You know, they have made a kind of a mark of not taking on Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, in order to survive as a state. Al-Qaeda, on the other hand, had this ongoing history of challenging local state, perceived corrupt state Muslim leaders. And so it kind of has the upper hand when it comes to the fight against Bashar al-Assad in the name of radical Islam. It's got Al-Qaeda as the upper hand over ISIS. But again, those distinctions are constantly blurring. We see both groups jockey for legitimacy. I think in the United States and in the West, the distinction between those two is often made because they're in the West, there are various security organizations that are jockeying for funding and attention. For example, for the FBI and Homeland Security, ISIS is more of a threat. And the more of that it is a threat, the more funding goes to those agencies. Why is it a threat? Well, because of its social networking capacities and ISIS lone wolves that are seen as potential terrorist threats. Whereas for the CIA and State Department, Pentagon, Al-Qaeda is the greater threat. And arguments that could go that way and say, well, Al-Qaeda is different than ISIS, it's winning the battle and so forth, are going to draw dollars further toward them because the traditional Al-Qaeda, you know, threat is one that's abroad and that's striking and targeting foreign interests. But again, I think that those distinctions are, in fact, less than they seem, and that there is just a much broader problem that needs to be addressed, which is, mobilizing international forces to help the refugee crisis, to address these broader regional power imbalances that continue to radically destabilize the area, and and not to just continue pouring weapons and arms sales into the solution.
I was interested to read in your book that from the 1980s, Sunni militants had tried to overthrow the Assad regime in Syria, both because it was a secular regime and because the Assad family are Alawite, which radicals and Al-Qaeda perceived as an evil mix of Shias, Christians, and Jews, and an outlier in the region.
Right.
How much of the opposition to the Assad regime is fueled by Al-Qaeda? And is that aversion to the Alawites one of the reasons the Saudi government funds the Syrian opposition in the civil war there, or do they fund that for other reasons as well?
These audio tapes, they feature speakers who are Syrian from the 70s and 80s, very much talking about the Alawite enemy. It's really the experience that the Syrians had fighting Hafez al-Assad, Bashar al-Assad's father, during the 1980s that galvanized a lot of Al-Qaeda's early supporters, the Arab Afghan folks that went to Afghanistan because they couldn't fight in Syria, but had very much hoped to bring that revolution back right into the Arab heartland, and to do so against Bashar al-Assad, against Alawis, and against Shia. So that, that legacy is there. It's being formulated under the Al-Qaeda label and in these training camps in Afghanistan in the late 90s, and it very much is a precursor to the rise of ISIS and what Al-Qaeda and ISIS are both doing now. One of the interesting things with Saudi and Western funding in this mess is that in Syria, there was traditionally a lot of Saudi funding for Al-Qaeda. Again, the argument always was, well, the Saudis don't want revolution at home, so they'll pour in a lot of money to these extremists to go abroad and kind of sell a militant message, the Wahhabi message, elsewhere, to wreak their havoc elsewhere, just don't bring it back home. So Al-Qaeda was often supported. And so what happens in Syria in 2011 when the revolution starts there is that the Saudi money, Gulf money, moves in to support the insurgents. But a number of Syrians start to say, well, this Saudi and Gulfi dollars, they are ruining our land. we want a state, we want a kind of a system in which all that outside money is not going to corrupt us. And some of those people that made those that early argument were not only the kind of more moderate, like secular West or pre-Syrian army folks, but they were ISIS people themselves. So some of the early 2011-12, what was surfacing was that early ISIS supporters who were contesting al-Qaeda and were contesting the Free Syrian Army and the Western back movement were saying, we are contesting them because of this money, these petrodollars that are you know, perverting any chance of genuine reform here in our country in the ways we know. And that was coming from ISIS people. It's odd to think of ISIS people having a kind of a depth of, you know, strategic vision or it's kind of an indigenous, you know, aspirations that are anything but atrocious. But that's part of the mess of what ISIS is and why it, you know, has continued to recruit enough people in the area to be able to survive.
You titled your book about Osama bin Laden, The Audacious Ascetic, and asceticism seemed to have been key to his life and also part of the way he marketed himself. Could you say a little bit more about his asceticism and how genuine it was or how manufactured it was?
Yes. Asceticism in Islam is primarily a struggle against the internal enemy. It's the enemy of selfishness and also desire for material goods in this world. So Islam has very rich traditions of asceticism, and the ascetic struggle is to be directed inwardly, right, toward yourself and making, kind of putting yourself into a kind of more ethical alignment with God's will and not just selling out to greed and wealth. Well, so Bin Laden was from a very wealthy family, a multi-million dollar Saudi family. He obviously, as he grew up, he had the career path that could have led him to be, you know, the 19th CEO in his family, or, you know, he had 53 siblings, so he would have been, you know, one of many dallying about with family wealth. But he saw the invasion of Afghanistan from Soviet troops as his card to, like, something different in life, right? And he had a religious bent. So he signed up for that, and asceticism was kind of something that he prided himself on. Ultimately, the Bin Laden story emphasized Bin Laden's capacity to take on America as the world's greatest economic power. And Bin Laden would speak to those points as well, and kind of identify the U.S. as a problem for Muslim countries because of its perceived corrupting economic influences. So in that battle, you know, many saw Bin Laden's asceticism as a war against a far enemy, that is, you know, what the United States and the West generally became known as, the far enemy. But as I show in my book, that message of bringing Islam's ascetic traditions to combat the far economic enemy never traveled very far among Muslims themselves. Even top al-Qaeda operatives, they felt like, okay, United States, the West is a problem, but more important are our corrupt Muslim selves, you know, closer to home. That is where the true and ultimate battle has got to be. And the only way in which, you know, the Bin Laden story of the audacious ascetic targeting the far enemy made sense was really through a much wider set of global sound bites that were mediated primarily in the West in the late 90s and then certainly after 9/11.
How do you think Osama bin Laden is regarded today in the Muslim world?
Well, his ideology is seen to have kind of precipitated, you know, the chaos of so much of what the Middle East is experiencing now. So he is, you know, seen, his ideology is seen as atrocious by most Muslims, and his legacies. The thing is that most living in the Arab world, and I've spoken with folks in Yemen and Arabian Peninsula and Syria, you know, they talk about Bin Laden as having been a kind of someone that whose threat capacities, you know, underlied the West's rationale for going into Iraq, for example, in ways that were in hindsight overinflated. So the whole story of the weapons of mass destruction, for example, the reasons we went into Iraq, all of that was wrapped up with al-Qaeda and bin Laden threat, right? In retrospect, there was no al-Qaeda in Iraq before 9/11, and there were no weapons of mass destruction, as we found. So, you know, many people look at the whole bin Laden story as having been one of a particularly imaginative Western imprint. And however much they hate bin Laden, they also see him as part of a figure, kind of a poster boy for a lot of other competing interests.
Professor Miller, in your book you say al-Qaeda is less a non-state actor, as it is so frequently depicted in counter-terrorist discourses, than it is a relation to state power. You write, quote, al-Qaeda remains a potent source of radicalism because it is so closely intertwined with the management of state authority in a messy context or in messy contexts of global interaction, end quote. Could you talk a little bit more about what that means and why you think Western policymakers and the public need to be more aware of al-Qaeda being more a relation to state power than a non-state actor?
Al-Qaeda is spoken about many times on these tapes. It's spoken about not as bin Laden's worldwide jihadi as organization, but as in Arabic, a rule or a base. And these are bases for Muslims in Islamic law. So what are, you know, and there are many books that are written about what these bases are. For example, Innocence Until Proven Guilty is a base in Islamic law that's well known. And there are, again, many books that elaborate hundreds and hundreds of these ideas about what are the bases in law or theology and so forth. So there are lots of tapes about those. What happens, though, among militants is that they listen to the lectures and sermons by men of learning, Muslim clerics and leaders about these bases, and they hear the preachers and clerics saying, you know, because these bases are so general, like Innocent Until Proven Guilty, they also need to be qualified in particular cases. Like, it's just the initial stepping stone that then you go in to investigate, you know, well, in Islamic law and legal courts, you know, how are these laws to be applied, and are there mitigating circumstances? So every rule has exceptions, but to know what those exceptions are, you need to be trained as a judge, an Islamic judge, a Muslim judge, or a qadi, or you know, a scholar, or so forth. Now, the militants come along and they say, we'll talk about the exceptions too, you know, these rules. We'll say, well, the West has attacked us everywhere, and, you know, or Muslim rulers have, you know, committed so many human rights abuses and imprisoned so many people for the wrong reasons that we now have the right to weigh in and make exceptions to the general rules, for example, against the use of violence or in the name of Islam against other innocents. So militants use that idea of al-Qaeda on these tapes in order to overthrow authoritarian regimes. So it's a religious idea at its base, and that's often missed in these larger discussions about al-Qaeda and what it is and so forth. But as a religious idea that it has a lot of history to it, it can be used by states themselves as they seek to gain legitimacy because Muslim rulers can say, okay, so they can say to opposition groups and to those who are vying for legitimacy, they can say, okay, look, we acknowledge our system's not perfect. We acknowledge that we're going to support some more radical interpretations, but just don't do it within our boundaries. Don't do it inside our borders. And so the states have an interest, I argue in the book, in supporting this kind of al-Qaeda exceptionalism, as long as, you know, those the radicals arguing for more, you know, political revolution and so forth, do so in across the border in other neighboring countries. So for Saudi Arabia, those include Yemen, those include Syria. You know, those are the places where al-Qaeda is flourishing. And, you know, those are the places that don't have the kind of security and power networks to be able to quash dissent and to manage, you know, religious authoritarianism in quite the ways the wealthier nations do. So that's why, you know, I argue al-Qaeda is this messier business, and it is one that has advantaged states as they broker arrangements with opposition groups in their own interest. And Bin Laden was part of that world, and he understood both how to exploit, you know, state power and to continue to tap donor money, but also to wreak havoc, you know, across borders.
In 1996, Osama bin Laden made his famous declaration of war against the United States. We're going to listen to a little of it, and then, if you could you explain what we're hearing on this tape?
إن الأموال التي تدفع ثمنا للبضائع الأمريكية تتحول إلى رصاصات في صدور إخواننا في فلسطين وبلاد الحرمين وغيرها، وإننا بشراء بضائعهم نقوي اقتصادهم بينما نزداد نحن فقرا وضعفا، وإن حرمان هؤلاء المحتلين من العوائد الضخمة لتجارتهم معنا إنما هو مساعدة هامة جدا في الجهاد ضدهم، وهو تعبير معنوي هام في إظهار غضبنا عليهم وكرهنا لهم، ونكون بذلك قد ساهمنا في تطهير مقدساتنا من اليهود.
All right, Professor Miller, help us out if you can and tell us what we've just been listening to.
Yes, this is his famous Tora Bora speech in the summer of 1996. He's been stripped of his citizenship, of all his wealth, made stateless, and so he comes up with this outlandish speech in which he talks about the kind of heresies of the Saudi Arabia and also the United States in supporting them. And he says in this excerpt, we remind listeners of the wealth that you devote to the purchase price of American goods will be transformed into bullets in the breasts of our brothers in Palestine, in the land of the two holy sanctuaries, which is Saudi Arabia with its cities Medina and Mecca, and elsewhere. In buying their goods, we strengthen their economy while exacerbating our own poverty and weakness. It takes on the United States in this speech, but it's set within the context of Saudi wealth and its ongoing inability to bring about reform in particular.
Professor Miller, thank you so much for your time. This is Margo Patterson with Tell Somebody on KKFI 90.1 FM.
Okay, Margo. Thanks so much.